Hi everybody, Duncan Green here. It's a sunny April day. I'm pumped with coffee and nice food. And I'm here to present the final development nutshell. The final excruciating sound of me rambling through the previous week's blogs because I am leaving Oxfam. Yes, 20 years. 20 years at Oxfam. Where do they go? It's finally time to move on. Don't worry, I'm going to keep blogging. I'm probably going to keep podcasting, a bit more of that later. But for the moment, this is me checking out. Dexit is dawning next week at the end of April on Tuesday. Had to happen sometime. So I'm going to talk you through my, I've been doing some sort of reflections on the blog and I'll talk you through some of those. And then I basically dropped the ball on this because I was traveling and then too consumed with the idea of leaving that I haven't done one of these for ages. So I can't go through all the posts since the last development nutshell roundup thing. So I'll just drop them in the links and tell you what I've written about or had on the blog. And you can go and have a look at the ones you're interested in. So the Dexit blogs. First one, the announcement. So I'm leaving. What's next? So as befits my advanced years, I'll be doing a few consultancies, like one I've just been doing in Papua New Guinea. Absolutely amazing program, a lot of fun. And I'll be spending much more time at the LSE, where there are lots of requests to expand our training work on influencing and advocacy, pretty much along the lines of the Global Executive Leadership Initiative I've been running there with Tom Kirk. So open call to all of you. If you want to join the fun, if you want to come and work with us, if you want to fund us, if you want to do training with your organizations, get in touch. But get in touch with me in my LSE email because my Oxfam email will not be working after next Tuesday. But the most exciting, scariest reason for leaving and prospect for the future is looking after my first grandchild who arrived just before Christmas. Her name is Cora Catherine Malarkey Green. And she already lives up to her name. She's gorgeous, but boy, when she's in a bad mood, the house, you know, the walls shake. We're loving looking after her, mostly. And I just have to prize her away from her doting parents in order to make sure we get enough FaceTime with our lovely grandchild. So the future of From Poverty to Power, we will be coming to you with a survey. In fact, it'll be going up very shortly. The blog is going to change and my role in it, but we're still working out exactly how. So yeah, we'll be consulting with readers. By all means, comment, make suggestions, and we'll be putting up a survey, but it'll take a bit of time. In the meanwhile, we still want people to contribute, so if you want to contribute, get in touch with Amit Srivastava in the Oxfam team, and his email's in the blog. He'll be helping me to post content in this transitional phase while we work out how involved I'll be, if at all, in the blog. I'd like to be involved. If I had to put money on it, I think I will stay involved, but it's not at all clear how much, in what capacity, etc. So enough about that. What about, you know, the 16 years of running the blog? So this is the end of an era, whatever sort of afterlife we arrange. But I'm doing a bunch of final musings, which you'll hear about in a minute. But to kick off that process, a few random stats. 3,357 posts so far. And I reckon that means at least 4 million words, okay? 4 million words. That's 40 decent sized books. So in that old saying that if you give enough monkeys enough typewriters, one of them will write Hamlet, I reckon I must have written something decent within those 4 million words. 16,236 comments, which is 5 comments per post. Readers' numbers are a total nightmare because Google Analytics has changed its way of measuring everything. But we think in the last 7 years, over 2 million people, 2,147,000 to be precise, unique visitors have visited on one or more occasions. Since the blog began in 2008, there have been 6.7 million visits. That doesn't add up. But that's Google Analytics for you. So all that you can really say is a lot. The busiest year, definitely COVID year one, 2020, for two reasons. One is everyone was stuck at home with nothing else to do. And the second is a fantastic bit of help from Bobi Wine, the Ugandan leader, political figure, and his cohort on our Coronavision song contest. If you want to know more, you're going to have to look it up, but there's a link in the blog. So if you want to stay in touch with me, as I said, I'm on the LSE email. I'll stay on Twitter despite its increasing shitification. No one reads it, no one uses it, no one retweets, no one interacts, but I'll keep plugging away, at least until something better emerges. And if all else fails, there's always good old LinkedIn. Now, next, I want to give some reflections on leaving Oxfam after 20 years. So one of the things I did when I got to Oxfam, and I recommend this, is start keeping a diary in the first, you know, just after I'd arrived. So I arrived in 2004, the end of 2004, as head of research, and then later moved across to strategic advisor. And I'd been rereading that diary, which I kept until about 2010, when it fizzled out. And it helps bring back those early days and prevents me from, you know, rewriting experiences, whether for good or bad, whether positive or negative, with the benefits of hindsight. So to give a flavour of the organisation I joined, here are some extracts from 2005, a huge year for Oxfam as a global campaigning force. And then some thoughts on how the Oxfam of the noughties, that 2005 Oxfam, compares to that of today. So 2005, as I say, a very big year. I was one of many who had qualms about the hubris and the lack of attention to national and local development in the Make Poverty History campaign, which dominated that year. But the diary also brings back the access and success we had under the Labour government in 2005 and the difficulties that came with that success. And here's just verbatim entries. March 2005. Today, the government publishes an amazing U-turn on economic partnership agreements with the poorest countries, backing down on some of their issues they were insisting on, offering alternatives, etc. Basically, they took on the entire NGO trade agenda. I even helped the woman in charge of trade policy at DFID, who was Diana Melrose, an ex-Famer and friend, draft bits of it when I went round for coffee last week. And sure enough, my stuff is in there. Once again, the lesson is that once NGOs unite, focus, do their homework, make the development case and come up with specific proposals, the government will change position. Democracy works. Boy, that feels a long time ago. June 2005. 2005 is living up to all expectations as a historic year. Yesterday, the G7 finance ministers delivered a debt deal, 100% of multilateral write-off for 18 HIPC, highly indebted poor countries, with others to follow. And 20 years later, we are back looking at a massive debt crisis, and people are talking about another debt campaign to get another write-off. Typically, with so much success in prospect, the NGOs have started kicking chunks out of each other, with Oxfam apparently the whipping boy of choice. Nasty cover story in the New Statesman, is Oxfam failing Africa, where our main crime appears to be not being sufficiently nasty to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Lots of quotes from World Development Movement, War on Want and Christian Aid. Now Bob Geldof has come in at the last moment on Gleneagles, taking the whole thing up several notches, and the NGOs, though not us, are all panicking about losing control. August 2005. The month slipped past, the G8 at Gleneagles comes and goes in a welter of NGO conflict and recrimination. Classic. We get an extra $16 billion per year in debt relief by 2010, so we start ripping each other's throats out, saying anything nice, while the politicians who bust a gut pull a disgusted face and move on. Then emerging from the big year, January 2006, well, the big year for Africa is over. That's what Tony Blair called it. We got movement in Gleneagles on debt and aid, fuck all on trade, lots of hype and profile, a backlash from Danny Roderick and Nancy Birdsall on the Make Poverty History agenda, and Matthew Lockwood's excellent critique in a book, The State Therein. So that was my 2005. Now, looking back from here and looking at the difference between Oxfam now and Oxfam then, three reflections. First, the unintended consequences of localization. I believe passionately in devolving power and resources, but there is a cost, which I hadn't really grasped until thinking about my reasons for leaving. My initial years at Oxfam involved a lot of travel for a mix of workshops and program visits. Those trips provided some of the key light bulb moments in shaping my thinking about development, although others came from reading, usually books rather than the grey literature about academic papers and NGO reports. I've drawn endlessly on what I learned during those visits to things like the fishing communities of Tikamgar in India, the struggles of Bolivia's Chiquitanos, Weekend's work to shift norms on against gender-based violence in South Asia, and stakeholder analysis in Tajikistan. But these days, I certainly would not be able to blog about how to run impromptu focus groups under mango trees, which is one of my early blogs. And I got getting drenched in Vietnam. I've dug up a photo of me literally standing in a field, a rice field, in 2005 with a black umbrella, getting completely soaked. About a decade ago, those kinds of experience dried up for me at Oxfam, although they continued through other channels, you know, LSE and so on. The invitation stopped coming, which may be just a consequence of my changing job profile, but I suspect it is also an unintended consequence of the backlash against white saviourism, concern over air miles, and the devolution of power within Oxfam. All these are laudable, but I wonder if an unintended consequence is that more staff in the UK no longer travel. I used to ask colleagues, when was the last time you talked to someone living in poverty other than a domestic servant or a taxi driver? The answer was often a matter of months, but I suspect for many at Oxfam House, it would now be a lot longer than that. Oxfam Australia once did a survey on staff satisfaction and found that the further people were away from Melbourne, Oxfam Australia's headquarters, the happier they were with working for Oxfam. The explanation was that people on or near the front line received daily doses of inspiration, but also of realism. They realised what a small player Oxfam was in a bigger tumult of change, and so they didn't beat themselves up about their failure to be transformational. I fear that devolution has exacerbated that divide. The further I get from Oxford and Oxfam, the better our reputation. During some recent work for the LSE with civil society organisations in the Middle East, they told me that Oxfam was the most respected NGO in Gaza. It doesn't feel like that when you're in HQ. Second point, from excessive hubris to excessive self-doubt. Perhaps that last point, that division between, you know, field and central office, is also damaging morale in Oxfam House. The Oxfam I joined was undoubtedly arrogant, captivated by its own sense of mission and importance. Even before I joined Oxfam, I remember attending the 2003 Cancun WTO ministerial, where I was working for CAFOD at the time, and watching in awe as a press conference of the trade ministers of China, India, and other major developing countries suddenly stopped proceedings to call and welcome Oxfam's Irungu Houghton onto the stage to present a 20 million signature petition calling for trade justice. Imagine how we felt, the other NGOs in the room. Envy, dislike, and super impressed all at once. And if anybody's got a picture of that event, I've asked Irungu and he hasn't got one. And Google doesn't have one either. So do please tell me if you've got one. I was part of pushing it back against that arrogance, especially through the book, From Poverty to Power, whose core argument was that development arises from the interaction between active citizens and effective states, i.e. development is primarily a national process, an implicit critique of the hubris of Make Poverty History and NGO rhetoric of the time. But in recent years, I've become concerned that the pendulum has swung too far the other way. It feels like Oxfam and many other NGOs, international NGOs, are plagued by self-doubt about their mission and even more so identity. This might be understandable as the question of what our precise role is in a decolonized future is a tricky one, but it also, I think, means we have given up influence in areas where global NGOs are still really needed. Stuff that hasn't changed. A couple of excerpts from 2005 bring home how little has changed in some aspects of life in Oxfam. First, a comparison with my previous employer, Difford. So how does Zoltan compare with Difford? Bigger in staff numbers, if you include the shops, but with 1/200th the budget. The resource is people, not cash. The people are finishers, not thinkers. Try to talk about something that's not in the campaign plan and a look comes over them. Anxiety and exhaustion and irritation are being distracted in this way. In Difford, they're always intellectuals. The emphasis on career development and learning, lots of high-powered, perhaps underemployed and politically naive graduates keen to attend a seminar or whatever. Oxfam is more conservative, more political, less curious. The rewards for entrepreneurship are greater, at least at team leader level in Difford. The minister or the SPAD, the special advisor or senior officials always want to be ahead of the curve, grab the next big idea. Not so Oxfam's head down implementers. There are thinkers, but they're dispersed, hard to locate, and it's not their day job. But God, do they implement. A fearsome campaigns, advocacy and press machine, huge ambition. That's comparison with Difford. And the challenges of treacle and internal leadership. Treacle, I mean, when you try and get something done within Oxfam, sometimes it feels like you're wading through molasses, through treacle, because of all the sign-off processes and the lack of clarity about how decisions are made. So many meetings, says the diary. And working as Oxfam International massively compounds the transaction cost behind any decision, with teleconferences galore. Already I feel I'm a wasting asset, too turned inwards, losing touch with the thinkers outside. So hard to keep facing out. But the potential and the platform are glorious. If I can just find a way for Oxfam to do thinking, to produce ideas, even if they're not tied to a campaign. And that's basically what I did in the blog, but this was written before then. A big challenge personally, to move the machine requires conviction, assertiveness, power. My natural tendency to self-doubt and contrarianism could be damaging. Already I can feel my initial ambition and freedom eroding. The new ideas starting to look just too difficult. And finally, I want to end this particular post by stressing that Oxfam has been good to me. It's given me the space to write and think in books and blogs, a space it has not accorded most of its people and is very rare in the wider development sector. All those cliches about the wonderful privilege of working with great people on the ground are completely true. I just read the proofs for the second edition of How Change Happens, which is coming out in June, and the number of stories and examples for Oxfam are incredible. I can barely believe that this all happened to me. And in case you think I was getting a little bit, you know, blowing my own trumpet, getting a bit too excited about myself, the next post was Learning from Humiliation, Shame and Failure. The photo I dug up for Tuesday's post of me wandering about in rain-swept paddy fields in Vietnam got me thinking about a recurrent theme of the last 20 years at Oxfam and earlier jobs too. The role of personal humiliation, shame and failure in learning. First, the Vietnam example. I went there full of the 2005 hubris I described earlier. Oxfam's big campaign at the time was on trade injustice, and we had just published a paper laying out the unfairness of the rules governing Vietnam's accession to the World Trade Organization, WTO. It was a deeply skewed process in which each existing member could take turns to gang up on newbie applicants. Each one would demand more and more concessions from the Vietnamese, and any concession then had to apply to all of the existing members. It was really bad. The Vietnamese government was delighted with our criticism of the negotiations and granted us a meeting with a member of the Vietnamese Politburo. Fantastic theatre, busts of Ho Chi Minh, marbled halls, red carpets, the works. When we got in, sat down, opposite us sat a very polite elderly woman. And I launched into a massively patronising presentation of the paper, just full of that 2005 arrogance I talked about earlier. And it was probably also, I'm afraid, laced with a dose of unconscious colonialism, sexism and ageism. You have to realise they are bullying you. It's so unfair, etc., etc. She listened politely and then said words to the effect of, well, you know, we lost 2 million lives in the American War. I think we've got this. I suddenly saw who was sat opposite me, probably a veteran of the war, a senior political figure, with all the experience I lacked. I wanted to curl up and die. That initial jolt made me reflect on all those isms I mentioned and the importance of trying to understand the power and point of view of the other point of view of the other povo in any conversation. I don't know if this is my individual pathology or a more general phenomenon, but those moments, and there's plenty of others, I've got a couple more here, stay with me. I learn far more from them than from any compliments or successes. So a couple more. And this is for my Oxfam colleagues who often think I'm too big for my boots, right? So here you go. These are for you. In 2010, Oxfam was preparing a big new campaign called Grow. The idea was to move from the negative framing of injustice, violation and poverty to a more positive frame that would help counteract the accumulated impact of decades of poverty porn and respect the agency of countless individuals and communities around the world. Fresh off the back of the launch of the book, From Poverty to Power, I said I would write the big campaign report. It had to be me. These were huge set pieces, these reports at the time. They still are. The foundations on which big global campaigns stand or fall, and I thought I was just the person to do it. Boy, did I get that wrong. What I failed to recognise about myself was that I had already fallen out of love with Oxfam's campaign model and the way of writing needed, and it wasn't helped by doing a PhD at the time. I could not get the tone right. My boss at the time said, "Why'd you keep quoting Charles Darwin? Couldn't you quote Bob Marley?" And this was after a blog I'd written about a hungry man is an angry man. Bob Marley lyric. And I failed to come up with the kind of killer facts that any campaign needs. Confession, I'm not a real researcher who can do that kind of thing. So it was a lamentable cocktail of arrogance and lack of self-knowledge. As the campaign launch day approached, the pressure of the slow motion car crash grew, and I ended up with attacks of vertigo and going into hospital with some weird tomato-sized abscess on my face. The report was taken away from me, and a fellow researcher, Rob Bailey, was drafted in to do what was needed ahead of the launch in 2011, which had all the Oxfam razzmatazz, with backing from Lula, Desmond Tutu, and Scarlett Johansson. As for me, the blog actually saved my bacon. It came to the rescue. My boss, the guy who told me to do more Bob Marley and less Charles Darwin, took me out to tea in a cafe on the Euston Road and said words to the effect of, "Normally we'd sack you, but too many people are reading your blog. You can't stay as head of research, so we need a job title that sounds important but means nothing." And I said, "Oh, how about strategic advisor?" And that's how I became Oxfam's strategic advisor, and it's been the best job title and the best job ever since. No one listens to my advice. I'm not particularly strategic, but I've had a great time. So lessons from that: know your limits, know where your mind and heart is at any given time, but also build your public profile just in case things go wrong. One more, what the hell, I'm leaving anyway. Getting a lesson in the power of localization. Just after I joined Oxfam, I was sent to the Lake District up in the north of England on a management leadership course with a bunch of other supposed future leaders. It was awful. In one of the exercises, two teams had to play remote human chess. Some of them were actual chess pieces on the board, moving around, or moving the other chess pieces. There weren't enough people to be all the chess pieces. At a distance were their randomly selected managers. So I was told, "You're a manager. You go and sit in that building half a mile away from the chessboard. You're the manager." The only connection between us was a runner who would run between a walkie-talkie taped to a tree and the chessboard. And there was added time pressure on all this. So me and my fellow manager were provided with a chess set. So we set out our chess pieces and we started moving the pieces around, and we tried to run the show without being able to see the board or what the other team was doing. The other team had someone much smarter than me, Kate Raworth, later of Donut Economics fame, as manager, who simply sent a message through to the players saying, "Any of you play chess?" And when they said yes, she said, "Right, over to you." And she went off and had a cup of tea. And we, the people trying to run things from remotely, got absolutely smashed. So that was my first lesson in the power of localization and handing over the stick. And I've never forgotten it. I have plenty more where they came from, but that's enough for one post, and I'm not contemplating a series, sorry. I did ask for people to give their own successes and stories of failure, and there were some pretty good ones, so thanks for those people who stepped up. Okay, so that's all I'm going to do for the moment. I mean, I've got, because I have dropped the ball on this, there's probably, 10, 15 posts which I could have gone through, but there just isn't time. I think the ones I'd pick up on that you should definitely read, a book review from a lovely book about India, Unequal: Why India Lags Behind Its Neighbors, by Swati Navarajan, who is it's a great book. I think I had a couple on how do we stop bad stuff happening and whether the theory of change for that is different from supporting good stuff. And also a pile of Gelly stories, which are these stories where I grab a microphone, shove it under someone's nose during my training sessions and get real life examples of these senior UN and INGO people and the small wins they achieve in places, well, not necessarily small, some of them are massive. So the woman who got early child development into the Sustainable Development Goals with a bit of help from Shakira, all the way to getting stakeholders together to tackle girls' education in Benin. It's a really nice set of practical stories from people who are at the front line. On that note, it's been fantastic. I'm sure I'll be podcasting at the LSE, but this is my last development nutshell. I hope you've enjoyed them. I talked to loads of people who say they listen. I'm not sure if they're lying, but anyway, hello everybody and goodbye.